This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, today is a very special episode because it marks a rather significant milestone in the life of the Magic Word Podcast. This is episode number 650. Yeah, amazing. We've been doing this for over 10 years, and we have reached this point, and we're continuing to go on beyond here. And I say that quite easily because this particular episode is actually broken up into two parts. That is the first part that we will have as our guest today, Mr. Steve Cohen, who is, of course, the star of his own one-man show called Chamber Magic in New York City, currently at the Palace Hotel in New York City. And it was broken up into two parts because it was a rather lengthy conversation we had when we sat down recently in Columbus, Ohio. We met there at the Magi Fest that was sponsored then by Vanishing Ink with Joshua Jay and Andy Gladwin. And Steve was the guest of honor, and I had an opportunity before things really got started and he got pulled in so many directions to go up to his room, and we got a chance to have a quite lengthy chat and kind of get caught up. We have not seen each other for quite some time. We've been going in different directions. Well, actually, I've been going in different directions, and I just don't get out to the city, in New York City, often enough to see my friends out there. But I have known Steve since he was quite a young man and used to attend the 4F convention in New York back before, when it was at the Forks Hotel, long before it had even moved. Well, anyhow, we get into that then a little bit, but also, more importantly, this first part is going to be talking mostly about his chamber magic and how he had developed the show, what he had done to get to the point where he can become what's known as the millionaire's magician, not a millionaire magician, but a millionaire's magician. And he also then, in the second half, which we will hold until next week, we talk more about his inspiration, that is Max Maligny. And he has a book he's writing about Max Maligny, a rather significant tome, which will be released sometime. Just some issues right now with the supply chain, I think, of getting here. He'd like to get it before Christmas, but who knows? Anyhow, that's going to be next week. So again, this is not unprecedented because we have had conversations with other people in the past. We've had extended conversations that ended up being into two episodes because I didn't want to have a two-hour episode, although we could do that on a podcast, but I think I'd rather break it up into one-hour chunks. And it seemed to be quite convenient to break it up between his chamber magic and also then the book on Max Maligny. So this is going to be just a very fascinating episode about how he really got into doing this one-man show and how he found the venue and his preparation for all this and how luck happened when preparation met opportunity. So please welcome my friend this week, Mr. Steve Cohen, here on The Magic Word. Today, I have somebody with me who is live in the studio instead of having someone that's remote, and we're sitting across from each other, and we're actually, it's kind of funny because I'm from Houston, he's from New York City, and we're kind of meeting in between. We were in Columbus, Ohio as we were speaking. Someone who we've been friends with for quite some time, you may have heard him, or if not, you've heard of him, and we're going to be having a great conversation, I know, and someone who is perhaps best known as the Millionaire Magician. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Steve Cohen. Hey there, Steve.
Hey there, Scott. I would say the millionaire is a magician, so there's an apostrophe S in there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, good point. Make sure. Not the millionaire magician, millionaire's magician. Millionaire would imply, obviously, you have millions, and so you're, but you perform for millionaires, so it's the possessive of millionaires.
Correct.
Right, got it. I understand. And because you have been performing, did that moniker come to you as something you thought of, or did someone once say to you, this is who you are, you've been performing, you know, that guy's a millionaire, or that guy's a millionaire, and before long you said, this is... That's me. I'm a millionaire's magician. Or did you come up with it, or someone else gave you that moniker?
Okay, so eventually I decided to use that, but I really fought it hook and nail. My best friend, Mark Levy, who's a magician, and he's also a branding expert, was the one who said, you should call yourself the Millionaire's Magician because you perform for the Rockefellers and for many wealthy folks.
Sure.
But we actually both heard that phrase first when I was called that in a media article in this magazine in New York called Avenue Magazine. And some reporter came to my show and she said, oh, you know, you're performing for all these A-list celebrities. We should, you know, he's as if he's the Millionaire's Magician. And that phrase just somehow kind of stuck in Mark's head, in my head. At one point, Mark said, look, you know, we need to figure out a way to make you stand out from everybody else. And I thought, well, maybe I can do some sort of a publicity stunt like David Blaine style.
Sure.
And that really, I mean, I'm a very kind of mild-mannered, you know, non-confrontational person.
You're not an introvert, but you are kind of a person to yourself.
Correct. Yeah. So doing that sort of, you know, public-facing publicity stunt didn't seem like the right thing for me. So instead, Mark said, look, why don't you just lean into what you are? Lean into the fact that you feel very comfortable performing for wealthy people. And he said, in fact, you should make a tagline, magic for the filthy rich. And I was like, no, that's going way too far. That's going really too far. He said, okay, but maybe not go that far, but if you lean into what you've done and who you are and where you feel comfortable, you'll find the right audience. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, what does that mean? He said, you should charge more for your services. And I said, well, I kind of charge a lot right now. He said, well, how much are you charging? And I think at the time I was charging around $2,000 for a show. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if you want to make $20,000 a show, you have to be comfortable turning down the $2,000 shows. So right. You'll never even get to the $20,000 show unless you're turning down the lower price of shows. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that feels very uncomfortable to me. I need to, you know, feed my kid, right?
Sure.
And I need to make a living. He said, well, it's a mental mindset. And what he said is print up some business cards to say the Millionaire's Magician. Start calling yourself that. See what happens. He said, I'm going to guarantee you that the right types of people are going to start contacting you. And I went to London to do the show in London for a month at the Langham Hilton. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, the British media loved that. They thought this is a brash American coming to New York, coming to London, calling themselves the Millionaire's Magician.
Who does he think
How
he
dare
is?
He, you know? And then the thing is that the show was really well received.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't like they were laughing at me. They were actually saying, well, this guy's really good and he's a Millionaire's Magician.
Yeah.
So then I had a lot of press. When I came back to New York after doing that successful run in London, it was kind of like Houdini. They called Houdini Europe's eclipsing sensation. Remember that?
I love it. Yes.
And so in a way, I was a reverse import. I was coming back to America with some really great British press. And then things just took off from there. So
now, was this before you were working? Of course, is the Ritz currently where you are? Is that right?
No. So I was at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel for 16 and a half years.
And so was this before or after you went to the Waldorf?
It was before and during.
Okay.
So yes, it was after I started the show and about like a year or so into it.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So in any event, I mean, it's strange because, you know, early on what I was doing was corporate events, private parties, mm-hmm. et cetera. Just like pretty much any other gigging magician, you know, a journeyman working, you know, in any capacity that's thrown my way. But I've always been fascinated by Hofstensser.
And Mellini.
And Mellini, too. I could talk a lot about
Mellini.
I ended up writing a 550-page book about him that's going to be coming out later this year.
Good. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So you know,
I love Hofstensser, too.
Well, Hofstensser, for me, was I just identified with him mm-hmm. because what I'd read was that he wasn't a bombastic personality, a bombastic stage performer. In fact, when he was doing some stage shows in Austria, he attempted some stage performances. There were complaints about Hofstensser's performance saying that his voice was too thin and no one could hear him. So this is who we idolized, the great Hofstensser. Mm-hmm. He was panned in the media because he just wasn't able to deliver in that setting. So what did he do? He said, okay, well, where do I feel comfortable? I feel comfortable in an elegant upscale environment, mm-hmm. circulating with the cognoscenti, circulating with the elite of Viennese society.
Cream of the crop.
And so he created a show that would be tailored for that type of audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. There's no guarantee that they will come, but if you have to start building it at least.
Mm-hmm.
So he started performing not a salon that was, you know, a salon for for people talking about politics or salon where people were talking about religion, he created a magic salon. And that was how the rich and elite people in Viennese society interfaced.
And that would, again, have been about the 1850s.
This is in the 1850s to the 1870s. That was when he had about it.
The salon he only had about a
14 or 15-year run in his salon. So in a way, the fact that I've been doing this show for over 20 years, I feel like, okay,
the new Hofsinger.
I got you.
Cohen, the new Hofsinger.
But there's no comparison. He's clearly the master, and he was incredibly inventive.
Creator, oh my goodness.
That's the thing that I bow down to him, was, you know, maybe I've kind of absorbed the format of his show, but the creative inventiveness of his magic was just so. I mean, he had one trick where he borrowed a lady's finger ring, made it vanish into a glass of ink, I believe it was, and then would circulate the ink, and the ink turned clear in the vessel. And then you'd see that there was a goldfish swimming inside that vessel. Mm-hmm. And he would scoop out the goldfish, and from the goldfish's mouth, he would extract the borrowed ring.
Wow. Wow.
You can't get any more creative than that. Yeah. So in any event, you know, so I was so fascinated by Hofsinger, and I was doing a lot of reading about him. In fact, I tore out a picture of Hofsinger that was in the Sphinx magazine. I carried it with me everywhere I went. This is when I was about maybe 27, 28 years old. And I showed that picture to everybody who I knew. I showed it to parents of my children's friends. I showed it to our dry cleaner. I showed it to everyone I could meet. I said, do you know any place that looks like this? Mm-hmm. And I found a beautiful venue that was called the National Arts Club in Gramercy Park in Manhattan, on 20th Street between Lexington and 3rd Avenue. And it's this beautiful mansion that is dedicated to the fine arts. Also performing arts, but mostly fine arts. So when you walk in, you see gorgeous oil paintings and sculptures and Tiffany glass ceilings, and it's really stunning. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. I wonder how I could become a member here. Mm-hmm. And the man who happened to be walking through the lobby that day was the president of the club. And I showed him some magic, and he said, you want to become a member here? I said, absolutely.
Wow.
And so it was just happenstance, but he said, yeah, we like to have performances here. Would you ever consider having a performance in a National Arts Club? I said, well, that, now that you mention it, that was, of course, what I had in mind all along. So I started doing the show there in the year. I started some private shows of chamber magic in the year 2000.
Okay.
And then 2000.
Just before 9/11.
Correct. And then 2001 is when I started the shows at the Gramercy Park National Arts Club.
Okay.
I did the show there for about two and a half months, but the problem was that it's a private club. And as you know, in New York City, over the summertime, everyone leaves the city and goes to the Hamptons, at least my crowd.
Long Beach.
Right. So since they're gone, the private clubs all take that two-month hiatus to do maintenance. And therefore, I wasn't able to use the club as my performance space any longer until September.
Okay.
So I had just started to build momentum, and I was getting people coming, and there was some media coverage, and I got in CBS Evening News, and it was like, actually, you know, it was starting to get a little bit of traction. But then the club says, sorry, we're closing for the summer. You've got to find your own, you know, thing to do over the next couple of months. And I realized I can't be beholden to some places, sometimes available, sometimes not, because I had these lofty dreams of making this show run for 20 years.
Sure.
I don't know. Somehow in my head, I thought if I could make a show run in New York City for 20 years, I'll be a success. And that was actually my battle plan.
If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere.
Truly. That was going through my head. Yeah. It still goes through my head.
Right.
Yeah. The Frank Sinatra song is, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. But I didn't want to go anywhere else. I wanted to stay in New York.
Sure.
And I just thought, if I can, you know, this is the most competitive theater market in the world. If I can make a show last year, then that stands for something.
Sure does.
So I began the show at the National Arts Club, realizing that this is maybe not the place for me. Mm-hmm. And at one of the very last shows, I happened to mention to the audience, I said, well, this is one of my last shows here. If anyone has any ideas of where I could bring this show next, feel free to speak to me after the show's over.
Wow.
It wasn't very shy. And sure enough, this woman came up to me and she said, you know, I work with the Waldorf Astoria. I'd like to introduce you to some of the executives. Maybe we can, I really enjoyed your show, but maybe we can make something happen at the Waldorf.
Right.
I had a personal invite that way. Mm-hmm. Now, she didn't work at the Waldorf Astoria. She was connected with some people who did.
Okay.
She had done events there. So she introduced me to the catering director of the Waldorf Astoria. Mm-hmm. And this catering director's first response she said is, "We don't do magic at the Waldorf."
I could imagine that, right? was just the gut knee-jerk reaction.
And she was right. You know, it's like everyone thinks of magic as being either a kid's show, a circus act, something goofball, corny.
Right. It's not just a respected art.
Exactly. And the Waldorf Astoria is, you know, it's a lofty and historical and historically important building. Mm-hmm. You know, it's housed every president of the United States when they come to New York. They have the presidential suite since 1931. They stay in the Waldorf Astoria. So, and, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia stays there. And, you know, there was a time when this is a great story as an anecdote. Someone called up the switchboard and they said, "Excuse me, I'd like to speak to, can you please connect me with the king who's staying there?" And the switchboard operator says, "Which king? We have three staying here."
Oh, that's a great story. Which king?
Yeah. Another story which is great is that showing how lofty the Waldorf was.
Yeah.
So there was a person that came to the hotel and was going to give a tip to the bellman or the doorman at the front door. Hmm. And he gave him a half a dollar.
Oh.
Maybe it was a quarter, a half a dollar. This is back in the 30s. And the doorman says, "I'm sorry, I don't take tips that don't fold."
You can have that back.
Exactly. I was thinking, well, you can give him a Johnson folding half.
That's funny.
Right?
Yeah.
But in any event, you know, it's a historically important place. And so for them to say, yes, we'll have a magic show, would be a great leap of faith for them.
Well, obviously, but after that, then they turned you down. I mean, you don't take no for an answer.
Oh, no. Well, no, I don't take no for an answer. But they didn't turn me down because the woman who I had met was adamant. She said, "No, you don't understand. This is not what you think. Give him a chance.
Yeah.
Give him at least a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
And you can send in your executive team, watch his show." And I put on some great shows those weeks. They were really great. I wasn't even doing the tea kettle yet. That was before that was introduced into the show.
Yeah.
But it was I was on fire. I mean, I hate to say it, but I really did really good kind of auditions. And
for came in for the audition?
Oh, it was for the executives of the hotel.
Like a half dozen people?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I think I did some ticketed shows that we invited the people to come
That's
see
what I was wondering.
The hotel.
Yeah, okay.
So they could see the genuine reaction.
It wasn't like you just went in their office and these guys sat with folded arms and goes,
"No,
this magic boy."
No, you don't understand. The room I was doing the show in was 42R. 42R was the same suite where the Duke and Duchess of Windsor used to live half of the year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was a top floor, and it has, beautiful glass chandeliers, Murano glass, and, you know, I mean, it was... I'm trying to remember there was some sort of Persian rugs. It was just a beautiful, beautiful suite.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I was doing the show in that room at all was extraordinary. So when people would come in, the first thing they're saying is, "Wow, we're in the Waldorf Astoria." Second thing they're saying, "Wow, this room is gorgeous."
Well,
and now they're in the right frame of mind. They're like, "Wow, this magic show is going to be great."
Mm-hmm.
Because they've walked through several frames to get there.
I love that.
And the frame
the
number
expectation,
one.
Expectation then.
Exactly. Frame number one is they had to get all dressed up, right? We have a dress code. So people must start thinking about the magic show maybe a few days before they're even going to come to it.
What
am I
going
to wear?
Yeah.
You know? It's like, and then the wife or the girlfriend might say to the boyfriend or the husband, you know, "What are you going to wear?" And he's like, "Oh, I don't know. And like it becomes like a team effort. And during the show, just as an aside, I always thank the audience for dressing up.
That's nice.
And I always see the women nudging with their elbow their boyfriend saying, "See, I told you.
Told you." Because on Broadway, a lot of times people anymore don't wear coats and ties.
No, you can go to...
Very casual.
You can go to a Broadway show, you know, the Disney... I know I was talking with the head of Disney Theatrical. And he says, "Hey, you know, we want bodies. We want people in seats. We don't care what they're dressed as."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "If you bring your kid, we'll give them the sippy cup." You know,
yeah.
So they really, you know, don't urge people or encourage people. I mean, the opera still does, right? If you go to the opera, or if you go to Carnegie Hall, people will, as a matter of tradition, get dressed up. But magic shows, who thinks you'd have to? I mean, maybe the Magic Castle, right? But typically, I don't remember what it was like in Magic Island. I think people used to get dressed up.
They did, in fact, until like the last few years, it went down. You could almost wear flip flops, but
exactly.
Leading up to that, it was nice. It was dress, coat and tie, and people wore nice attire.
And didn't you feel that people
had
a different experience?
Absolutely.
Right. So I'll make another aside. I used to live in Tokyo for many years.
I remember
Japanese, and
And your wife is Japanese.
That's right. And I worked as an interpreter for the Japanese government. And
that was your reason for moving over. I mean, you didn't know Japanese at the time. Is that right? You learned Japanese once you got there, and then you started teaching English to the Japanese? Was that it? Or
I knew Japanese before I got there.
Okay, but you were teaching English.
I did teach English when I was there for a couple of years, and then I was doing magic and then doing interpreting, and then I left. But I lived in Japan for 5 years.
See, that goes back, I mean, just as an aside then also, while we're kind of off topic for just a second, when we had first met, when you were at the 4F, because you and your buddy Mark Sisher.
Yes.
You know, and now were you in high school at the time? How far back does that go?
I went to 4F for the first time when I was 16.
Okay, yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Yes, I was still in high school.
And Mark was your age, too.
Mark
was
about a half a year older than me. So we used to go to Fector's.
He was such an inventive
guy. He was great. He was great. And I'm still in touch with his family. We were very close.
Yeah.
And I've got plenty of stories about Mark. So anyway, so
did he pass of cancer? What kind
of? Yes, he died from bone marrow cancer.
Bone marrow cancer.
Yeah, it was a shame. Age 22, very young.
Yeah.
So in any event, so when I was living in Tokyo, I had the chance to work and speaking, doing my shows in Japanese. I did two different nights of the week. One night I was doing walk-around magic at a place called the Ginza Lion, which is a brasserie, a bar, kind of a bar, a beer hall.
Yeah.
In the Ginza, which is, as you know, one of the most kind of high-end areas of Tokyo.
Okay.
But regardless of how high-end the area was, it was a beer hall. So people were going there to blow off steam and just
get drunk, yeah.
The other day of the week, on Sunday, so that was Friday nights, was at the beer hall. On Sundays, I worked at the Park Hyatt Tokyo, which is and still is, was and still is, one of the best hotels in Asia. It's
in all of Asia.
In all of Asia, not just Japan.
Wow, okay.
Through my connection, I went to Cornell University, so my connections with the Cornell Club, I ended up meeting the director of the managing director of the hotel. You know, Cornell has one of the best hospitality schools in the world. So so a lot of the people who graduated from the Cornell Hotel School end up going on to run some of the big hotels.
Did you graduate with the hospitality degree?
I was not in the hospital. I studied psychology.
Okay.
But I knew a lot of the guys.
Which is good for magicians.
Very good for magicians.
So yeah, that knowledge.
So when I was at one of the Cornell Club events in Tokyo, I spoke to the managing director. I said, you know, I would really love to do magic at the Park Hyatt. It would just be a dream come true. He said, consider it done.
Give it a try. Okay.
So, so I did. Wow. I did some magic just for him and his staff again, just to kind of give them a feel for what it was like.
Sleight of hand?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And again, speaking all in Japanese, this is all a Japanese act. And I was doing, and I got booked and hired to work every Sunday at the Sunday brunch for 3 hours.
Walk around?
Doing walk around in Japanese for the Japanese clientele. And
did they really respect you as an American speaking Japanese?
Yes, yes.
And so it's like this was an anomaly?
It was a real anomaly. But the reason I brought this story up is that I found that despite the fact I was performing exactly the same magic at the Ginza Lion Beer Hall and the Park Hyatt Hotel. Yeah. The reaction at the Park Hyatt was on a completely different level.
Why?
And the reason is because the venue defined their experience. They weren't in a beer hall. They didn't come in, you know, just to kind of get loaded. They came because they wanted to be, they wanted an escape from their own life. They wanted an escape from their norm. They wanted to see something which is elevated. And the fact that they had to go up to the 52nd floor of this hotel, where you have a panoramic view of all of Tokyo.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there was an American coming up to their table, speaking in fluent Japanese, doing some great close-up magic. All these things were just kind of a sensory overload. And the reactions were just so much better. And I ended up getting bookings, private bookings, from that Park Hyatt Hotel, which were so far beyond what I was trying to accomplish at the Ginza Lion.
Wow.
And I really do believe that. And I learned from that experience that the venue defines the experience in many ways. It's kind of like the picture frame around your picture. You can buy a very expensive picture, put it into a crappy frame, put it up on your wall. I've done this. And people say, yeah, that's a really beautiful picture. I wish it had a better frame, right? And same thing can go in the opposite, in reverse. You could have a really beautiful frame and kind of like a kind of a mundane photo or picture in the middle of it, and it doesn't look balanced. But if you have a very beautiful photo or very beautiful image, and then it has a beautiful frame around it, it just feels more cohesive and it feels right.
So if you have a show in a hotel banquet room, and you can appoint that however you want, as far as bringing in some drapes or whatever, and you've got a wonderful show, the experience, and even if people are coming in dressed, the experience will be better if you're actually in the presidential suite of that hotel.
Absolutely,
100%.
I mean, I don't do
shows. And you
can
charge more for it, too, because of the experience they're expecting.
Exactly. I mean, I've done shows in conference spaces. Like when I did shows in Los Angeles, I did the show at the Beverly Hills Waldorf Astoria. And they didn't have any – they don't have any large enough private suites.
Yeah.
And when I say large enough, I mean I need a room that's about 3,000 square feet.
Yeah.
So that we don't feel like we're cramped.
Sure, of course. Won't be spread out.
Right. And so when I was at the Waldorf, my suite was a 4,000 square foot suite. Mm-hmm. And it was actually the room where I lived from Thursday through Sunday. So I stayed lived in the hotel in my showroom.
What about your family? Did they come and live with you then?
Yeah, they came. They would come. They would come in the beginning of the weekend, in the end of the weekend, in the middle of the weekend. They would go off and do their family stuff. But we still had all of the children's birthday parties in our hotel room.
Nice.
And you know, the kids kind of grew up in the lap of luxury.
Well, the reason I mentioned that is because my good friend and one you talk to regularly, I'm sure, is Ben Jackson in Houston. And Ben is a magician who's got his own show in Houston. And
I met him. Yeah, he came to my show once.
He did. Yeah. And he had said he had spoken to you a time or two. I think he's also spoken with Dennis Watkins about his show in Chicago. And he's trying to get to that point. And he has an excellent show. And it is certainly worthy of a standing ovation and everything. If he could put that into a presidential suite type of room, that would elevate that. I'm just thinking.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay,
you know, for example, when I did the show in San Francisco, I did the show in the presidential suite in the Ritz-Carlton, and it was the same room where Michael Jackson used to stay.
Hmm.
And it was great, and it was just, it has a story about the room. It's not just we're in a room.
Yeah.
There's something special about the fact that we're even here.
Yes.
And, at the Waldorf, the situation was that you're going up in this private entrance, through a private elevator that usually the Secret Service uses to escort the president. Mm-hmm. I remember one time I was in the elevator and I was standing right next to Richard Branson. Another time, right down the hall from me, was staying Angelina Jolie and her family. So I ended up doing magic for her and her kids.
Yeah.
And then we go down the elevator together. So it's just, you're just rubbing shoulders with people. And that's the environment. So, there were many times when, for example, when Harry Potter movies were being filmed and the whole cast was staying at my hotel on my floor. So as people are coming and going to my show, walking down the hall, they're bumping into Ron Weasley. It's like that. And I'm walking down the hall. I said, Martin Short. Hey, you want to come to my show tonight?
It just seems surreal.
Yeah.
I would think.
It was pretty amazing. The Waldorf, also was a host to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the NASCAR celebration that they have at the end of every year. So I was, literally bumping into everybody, Stevie Wonder, and the list goes on and on. And then you get, for example, the concierge would contact me and say, we have Paul Allen here. Paul Allen was the co-founder of Microsoft. His yacht just pulled into the harbor. He wants to come see your show. He said it's on his bucket list.
Wow.
And I said, we're sold out, but yes, we'll make room for him. And he's he also has his captain of his ship and his private chef and his trainer. Like, okay, we'll make four extra seats, So it was a wild ride, I have to be honest. It was pretty crazy.
Wow. What would be one of your favorite story, aside from that was a good one. Any others as far as some people that you met or who have been some celebrities who have come in and have said something to you about the show?
The list goes on. Woody Allen came. He said the show was a religious experience for him.
That's interesting.
Which is really sweet. Yeah. One of my favorite experiences was I did a show for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And I've done lots of shows for the royal family of Saudi Arabia, particularly.
Much like Mellini.
there's a big parallel. So when I got booked for this, it was in my showroom, but they wanted to do it at midnight because the royal family, usually when Saudis come to New York, they're still on Saudi Arabian time.
Okay, gotcha.
And rather than, shifting to our schedule, they'll stay on their schedule and make everyone shift to their schedule.
Okay.
So they said, why don't you get here at 7 p.m., but we're going to start at midnight. And I said, well, if you need me at midnight, I'll get there at 11:15.
Yeah.
They said, no, but the Crown Prince might want you to come on at 8 o'clock. I'm like, well, if it needs to be 8 o'clock, then I'll be there at 7, 7:15. They said, no, but it might be at midnight. It might be 1 o'clock. You have to just be in a holding pattern.
So what do you say?
I'm like, okay, Fine. You know, I mean, like this, you don't often get a chance to perform for royalty. And when you do, you kind of have to just bend to the situation.
Their whims.
Exactly. I mean, it's not even whims. It's just, you know, he was ill at the time with cancer. That was why he had taken time to come to New York. He was at Sloan Kettering.
Towards the end of his life?
It was near the end of his life. And so, you know, he really was, we were all working around his schedule.
Sure.
And so anyway, they said, okay, we need you to come on ready in about 15 minutes. I'm like, okay, great. So I see him, I set my show up. I see him kind of saunter in. He sits in a throne, an actual throne that they had prepared for
him. They brought with Saudi to the hotel.
It was a beautiful throne. And so I'm standing far, far away from him. And usually I perform on the long end of the room, but they wanted it to me to be at the short end of the room. So
sure.
So usually I have like a wide audience in front of me, but they wanted it to be more of kind of like a palatial situation where he was at one end of the room and I was far away at the other end.
Gotcha.
And there's an empty space in between. And then line
there were no seats between him
nothing,
and you.
Nothing, nothing. Just empty space, like almost like a dance
hello,
floor.
Hello, hello.
Yeah. then on both sides of the room, on the long walls, mm-hmm. were sitting many of the other princes from the royal family.
Wow.
Okay, and they're all looking,
with their heads turned, looking at you.
They're all heads turned, looking at me, and but they wouldn't laugh or clap unless he laughed or clapped, because he was the most important person in the room. So I know that these guys spoke English because I spoke a little bit to some of them, but I knew that the crown prince only spoke through his interpreter.
Okay.
And he has an interpreter there. So he might have understood what I was saying, but he would only speak to me through his interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
So I performed my first couple of bits and they flopped. I mean, they were fine,
but
there was just no reaction. It was crickets.
Yeah.
And then I performed the second one and nothing. I'm thinking, okay, maybe there's a problem here. Maybe he can't see me because I know he's got vision problems.
Yeah.
So I was told you can't walk past a certain line in the sand. It wasn't
invisible
a line.
Line. Yeah.
It was just like, you know, don't walk this far past this area of the room.
Yeah. Don't approach the king.
Correct. And I realized I was too far from him. So I walked a little bit closer and closer, and I kept on getting closer and closer to that line. And suddenly he started to laugh.
Oh.
And then everyone around him, oh, wonderful, wonderful. So I realized like there was a threshold I had to pass in order to. But then at one point I started doing a $100 bill switch routine.
Yeah.
So can I borrow a dollar bill from someone? I changed the dollar into 100. And then the crown prince says, do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, I had the feeling this might happen. So I actually had a whole bunch of thumb
ready,
tips all
ready.
Set.
Yeah.
I had like four thumb tips set up, all of them ready. And so I borrowed another dollar, and I said, okay, no problem. Give me another dollar. And I changed it to another 100. And I'm giving these out to the guys. You know,
of
like,
course, because you're matter. Being paid well. It's just 100 bucks.
Right. And so, and then at one point, there was one prince. I think his name was Prince Shteyt. That's the name I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of like the black sheep of the family, the one who people always make fun of.
Mm.
So they said, do it again. And I said, okay, no problem. Prince Shteyt, do you have a $100 bill? He goes, let me check. And he reaches into his pocket, pulls out a $100 bill.
Yeah.
And I did a $100 bill switch back to a dollar and gave it to him. And everyone they loved that. They, oh, it's like, we got him. We got Shteyt, you know. And that was like the moment where I knew I had them now for the rest of the show. And then I did that wonderful bit. I think it's Bill Goldman's where you change a dollar to a five to a 10 to a 20 to a 100. Have you seen that before?
I have.
And then I did that for the crown prince right in front of his eyes. He said, come closer. So I walked past that line.
Okay.
So I did it right in front of his eyes, the one to five to 10 to 20 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, this is great. And he leaned to his interpreter and he said, tell him to give us his address. We'll send him a truck full of dollar bills. So that was the moment I knew I had the crown prince. But I had also been told that he has a very short attention span and that he might, in fact, wave me off. And I didn't want to be waved off because I thought that would be kind of, you know, not insulting, but it wouldn't feel like I was going off on a high moment. So they said it might be only after 15 minutes where he waves you off.
Mm-hmm.
And my show is usually an hour and a half, you know, but I was going to make it into an hour. So anyway, I did 55 minutes, and I got a great reaction in the final piece, which was a book test with a drawing duplication. And I waved myself off. I said, thank you so much. Good night. And he never was able to wave me off. So I felt like that was
left on your own terms.
I left on my own terms, which I thought was really great. But having done that one show, I ended up performing for the Saudi royal family maybe 20 or 30 more times.
At the Waldorf?
At the Waldorf.
They or did always... they ever call you to come to Saudi?
No, I never went to Saudi Arabia. I've been asked to come to Qatar. I'm going to go there next year. Mm-hmm. I did a show for the royal family of Qatar recently.
And they fly over? Do they come over in a private jet?
They have their own airways, Qatar Airline.
But do they fly you
yes.
in? Okay.
Yes, in their own plane. The thing about doing these shows for the royal family is that they never come on time. So like that's the one thing I've learned is that they'll say, okay, we'll do a show for you at midnight. And remember, I've already done a show at 2 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting up for them to start the show at midnight. And I'm mm-hmm. pretty wiped at that point. I'm pretty exhausted. But they may not show up till 1 o'clock or 1:30 in the morning. And I'm just sitting there twiddling my thumbs. Mm-hmm. And how do I know they're even going to show? And the way I know they're going to show is they sent ahead stacks of $100 bills, and they've already been delivered to my room. So I know I'm going to be – I've already been paid very finely for this performance that has yet to be. But I'm just waiting for them to show up. So, you know, I'm just drinking glass of cups of coffee behind the scenes. And eventually they come, and a lot of times, you know, they're chatting to each other in Arabic because they know I don't understand it. And one time I did the Malini Brick from the Hat production.
Yep.
And right before I was about to lift up the hat – one of the guys said something to another guy in Arabic. He said, and he must have said, hey, you pick it up. And so I didn't even get a chance to...
Had the other guy.
Yeah, he was talking to the other, one of his friends. Okay. And so this other fellow then reached for the hat and snatched off the table and produced the brick. And I didn't have a finale because they ruined the finale for me.
I was like, ta-da!
You know? But, you know, that's the fun thing about, you know, performing for people in different languages, different cultures, you know. Again, it sounds very highfalutin that I'm the millionaire's magician. And yes, I perform for probably about 50 billionaires and many times in their homes or on their private jets or in their private islands. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like to perform magic for anybody. And right. I love to bring magic to, you know, my show, for example, is not, we don't have a net worth indicator when you walk in. Like, you know, people,
not.
They right. you could buy a ticket and see the show. Anyone can.
That may be the last $100 or whatever it is.
It may be.
That
may
they
be.
Have. It's like, this is what I want to do, it and I'm going to spend it to do this.
And I'd be honored to be that, that, you know, that entertainment. You know, I've in the beginning, I wanted to do it because I wanted to become rich. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to interface with people who would help me get rich. Mm-hmm. But now, I've done well for myself. And for me, more than anything, I just wanted to share really powerful magic. Mm-hmm. Because then people will spread the word for me. They become my emissaries. The tricks are the emissaries for the show, and then the audience becomes my PR machine. I don't advertise. I don't have to, you know, promote the show. But it's been running for 21 years now.
Sold-out audiences.
And sold out every show. Had over 500,000 people come to visit it.
And you usually sold out, like, what, 2-3 months in advance?
There was a time where I was sold out for a year.
Oh, my goodness, Steve.
I'll tell you that story. So when I first started, you know, like, this is going back to the Waldorf, the early days, mm-hmm. nobody knew of magic shows in hotels. That wasn't the thing you did. You know, now, like you mentioned before, there's a bunch of guys who have, you know, have seen that it works and have opened up a show in Chicago or in Houston, right? In other cities. But it wasn't a thing. You wouldn't go say, oh, let's go see a magic show in a hotel. People hadn't heard of this. So I was really fighting an uphill battle, right? And there was a time when I thought that the show might actually fold. I didn't think there was even going to be enough audience members. And then one day, a lady came to the show, and she ran a it wasn't even a website because there was no internet really at the time. This is still in like 2001, I guess, 2002. People knew what the internet was, but it wasn't really what it is today. There was a what she called, I guess it was an email blast. It was like email blast service. And the editor of that came to the show, and she loved it, and she wrote an email blast for her list. And from that one email, which is basically just two paragraphs talking about how great this magic show is, I sold out the show for a year.
Just based on that, for that one blast?
Yes. It was every Friday night for the rest of the year.
Wow.
And I was like, this is unbelievable. And now suddenly, like, where I was begging people to come in, now there was this very hip, young crowd coming because everyone who was on the email list were these, like, very beautiful, young, attractive women with their dates. Yeah. So I had a young, happening crowd that was my new fan base.
You just got the right influencer, basically.
Yeah, it worked out well. And that was by happenstance. But, you know, again, they always say, you know, it's a combination of preparation meeting opportunity, right? So I got lucky in quotation marks. So then the best part was about a year goes by, and or maybe a year and a half, and someone from CBS Sunday Morning came to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And CBS Sunday Morning, as you know, is a national broadcast.
I watch that show. National yeah, the show. Arts Channel.
They
arts
do
show. Yeah.
Fantastic segments about interesting things going on in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the producers came to see me. She loved it. She said, would you be interested in doing a segment? I said, sure, why not? I mean, I didn't know really. I never watched the show, so I didn't really know how influential it was. And they put on a segment, 8 minutes, and that sold out the show for another year. And I had to add an additional day. It wasn't just Fridays now. Now it was Fridays and Saturdays.
Okay.
And that one broadcast sold in the first day $600,000 worth of tickets. And by the end of the week, $1 million worth of tickets.
That kind of reminds me of the old Johnny Carson show. Remember, if you get on Johnny, all of a sudden you were made man.
That's what happened.
You could perform anywhere. You get an agent and everything.
That's what happened. And, yeah. so then 6 months later, they re-aired that segment, and the same thing happened again.
It happened again.
So then I had to add more shows, which was I had to add a Saturday matinee. So now I was doing...
Did you have families coming into the matinees because it
yes,
was... Okay.
Yes. So there's two shows on Friday night, three shows on Saturday.
Did you increase your price?
Of course. So here's the other thing. So there's something that's called a Veblen good. Have you ever heard that expression before?
No. What is that?
So...
Is that an economic term?
It is. So if you're an econ major, one of the first things
Keynesian
you learn
theory.
Is about the first thing you learn about is the law of supply and demand.
Yeah.
And usually as the price would go up, then the
demand.
The demand might go down only because there's not as many people who can afford it.
Correct.
So there's an economist whose name was Thorstein Veblen, who was the man who created the term conspicuous consumption.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he identified something which is called a Veblen good. Now, Veblen good is something that is essentially a luxury item,
mm-hmm.
A yacht, a Louis Vuitton bag, Ferragamo shoes, expensive watches, Patek mm-hmm. Philippe,
right.
Tiffany jewelry, etc. And Veblen goods have a peculiar phenomenon, which is that the higher the price goes, the higher the demand for it. So something becomes more unable to attain makes you want it more.
Okay.
It's like the high fruit on the tree. Okay. Say, I really want that apple, the super high up. I'm going to get that apple.
Yeah, even though it tastes the same.
It may taste the same.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember going one time when I was a kid, when I was newlywed with my wife, kind of feel like a kid. When I was a newlywed with my wife, we went on a trip to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to a factory outlet for Prada, mm-hmm. the expensive leather brand and clothing brand. And Prada has a sister company, which is called Miu Miu.
Not familiar
and
with them.
So they were at this factory outlet selling Prada wallets and Miu Miu wallets. And usually you never see them side by side because they're two different boutiques. They would find one on Fifth Avenue, one on Madison Avenue, for example. But at this one store as an outlet, they had them side by side. And I was looking at them, I was going, these wallets are identical. The only difference is there's a brand name Prada with a little, plaque on it, and Miu Miu, which has an embossment with the brand name. But aside from the brand name, they are mechanically or physically exactly the same product. How come this one is so much more expensive? And it's because of the brand name. And so I thought to myself, what can I do for pricing? And so, in the beginning I thought, well, I'll be cute, $52 for a ticket, because that's the same number of cards and
deck
cards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that was confusing to people. Like, why $52? So then I thought, okay, we'll make it 55. And then I thought, okay, well, hold on. People are coming in without any resistance. Let's make it 65. And then no resistance, 75. Then we make it 85. Then we're going up to $95. I'm like, can I possibly sell
push it over 100?
$100 ticket to a close-up magic show? And then we're 125, then 135. And it kept on going up. It was like watching the wheels on a slot mm-hmm. machine go mm-hmm. by. And then I realized that we could start to charge more for the center seats, and we could charge more for the front row, and we could charge more for the front row center seats and the second row center seats because people wanted to have a better view down the center aisle. And there was a point where I got the tickets up to $750 a ticket.
For the premium seats.
For the premium front row center seats.
Congratulations, and Steve, on you.
They were $1,500 for a couple to come see the show.
Yeah. And they were doing it.
And yeah, and people were buying them. And the people who were buying them, I remember one family that came, oh, yeah, we're Picasso's grandchildren. Like, okay, you know, this is my audience. These are the people who they don't. There's the higher the price, the more they want to come see it. And so again, I'm not a businessman. I've learned to think like a businessman, but I'm not a businessman. I'm a magician. But I've learned how to think the way that my clients think.
I heard that advice kind of from, I believe it was Anton Zelman, who goes by the Millionaire's Mentalist.
Okay.
Used to be, some many years ago, and working a lot of trade shows. And he said when he first started doing some strolling, he didn't know what to charge. And so he was charging $100 an hour, and no problem. They would tip him like another $100. He said, well, I should have charged $200 an hour. And then he did, and then he'll tip him another $100. So I should be like at $300. So he kind of got to the point where they were no longer tipping him. So he felt like, okay, I must have hit that right point.
I see.
per hour.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, the fact is, again, I'm not a businessman. I'm a magician. So I feel like if someone's going to pay that much money for tickets, they better have a damn good time.
Yeah.
In other words, this show better live up to it, or else they're going to feel like they're ripped off.
And do they? Afterwards, that was another follow-up question. I was going to ask you, like those people that say the Picasso, you know, errors, or are they coming to you and saying, man, not that it was, not they're going to say this was worth it, but they were just saying to you, this was a great show, I had a great time?
They invited me to their house.
I got a chance to see
the Picassos on their wall and took me to the gallery where they have more Picassos for sale and... Yeah, and personal private tours of a Picasso collection.
That answers the question. So that's the right price.
Yeah. So it's, you know, again, it's, I don't want to feel, I don't want people to feel like they've been exploited, right?
Of course not.
Because, you know, if someone is a billionaire and you say, okay, well, you're a billionaire, so I'm going to charge you, you know, proportionally, then people are going to say, well, hold on a second. What's your price? You know?
Sure.
So you have to know that you're giving people value, which means you have to have a really solid show. So I'm a magician at heart, and that's my all-consuming passion. So again, I've learned to think like a businessman, but I feel like I'm delivering a really good product. I know you came to my show way back when.
I did in Houston.
In Houston, yeah. But the show has gotten, I think, you know, more solid and comfortable since then. Like, I think I had, at that time, I feel like I had to prove something, but now I feel like I've kind of finally grown into my show after having done it, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 times.
Right.
So.
And you really are not on the road anymore. You know,
I'm not on the road. Yeah. I mean, the only time I'm on the road is like, for example, this weekend. So we're here in Columbus, Ohio at the Columbus Magi Fest. Why am I even here on a weekend, right?
Yeah. You're giving up money.
No, I'm not giving up any money.
Okay.
The reason is because every September, the United Nations General Assembly is held in New York. Now, because it's on First Avenue on the east side of Manhattan, they block off barricades the entire east side of Midtown. My hotel, when I was at the Waldorf, and also now at the Lotte New York Palace, those two hotels are a block apart. That falls in that zone where you basically can't enter. So I can't do shows every year for the last 2 weeks of September for the public. To give you an idea of how severe it is, right across the street from my hotel, there are snipers on the rooftops.
Holy moly.
With, you know, with their rifles aimed or ready to be aimed at any intruders to the hotel. They have Secret Service at every entrance, metal detectors, the whole nine yards, you know, canine patrol dogs. So it's, and I've been there, and it's a lockdown. You really can't move. So if I were to invite the public to my show, it would be maybe the bullet catch, you know, it would be a different act.
Yeah.
So the last 2 weeks of September are the only weeks of the year that I could actually take off and tour, which is when why I've done shows in Chicago, done shows in L.A. and all over the country, and the shows in London, et cetera. This week happens to fall the last 2 weeks of September, so that's why I'm here.
That's why
it just
here.
Worked out beautifully. And I mean, I feel flattered. Vanishing Ink is giving me the guest of honor.
That's right. You're
for the as the guest of honor award for this convention.
Yeah.
And you know, when Josh first contacted me about it, he said, "We want to give you a lifetime achievement award." And I'm thinking to myself, did he call my doctor and find out something that I don't know about my health? But
you're still a very young man.
I'm 50 years old. I run marathons. I keep myself in really good shape. My cholesterol's low. You know, so I don't expect that to happen. But it's quite an honor.
Why did you move from the Waldorf over to the Ritz? Was the Waldorf going under remodeling or something?
Okay, so I moved the show from the Waldorf to the Palace Hotel, not the Ritz-Carlton, but the Palace.
Palace.
And the reason was because the Waldorf Astoria was bought by a Chinese insurance company. Now, remember, this is an American iconic hotel, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Smack in the middle of Manhattan. It's just, like I said, the home of
it's
every
like
United
buying
States
Yankee
president's.
Stadium.
It is like buying Yankee Stadium. And so this Chinese company bought the building for just shy of $2 billion.
Wow.
And then stated that within the next 2.5 years, they're going to remodel the entire building, sink another $1 billion into it. So they were talking already $3 billion
yeah.
up front to turn it into condos / hotel.
Okay.
So and because the National Historic Society was involved, many of the historic spaces couldn't be touched.
Couldn't be, right, exactly.
So the ballroom and the entrance lobby and the
some of the
clock
suites.
And so, not the suites.
Oh,
unfortunately, but
the main public
the
areas.
Public the main public yeah. areas like you know the
there registration area, the bar.
There was one beautiful room where Cardini performed when
wow.
Cardini was alive. I actually have he performed for the United Nations General Assembly. And I have the program of when he performed at the Waldorf, mm-hmm. and I know the room. It's called the Jade Room, right down the hall from the ballroom. Anyway, so those spaces are fortunately going to remain intact. But
mm-hmm.
everything above that, they're ripping it out. They're ripping out everything. It's like a big empty box now. And the problem was this was supposed to have been completed by 2019.
Okay.
Okay, so they closed in 2017. Mm-hmm. I was there up until the very last day.
Yep.
Stevie Wonder performed at the final gala, which I was at, and everyone said goodbye. And by 2019, they were supposed to reopen. However, the owner of that of the hotel, it was called Anbang Insurance,
mm-hmm.
the president of that company, Chinese national, was involved in an insurance scam, a big scandal, and ended up in jail. For 16 or 18, I forget, years.
Okay.
And so all of the holdings of Anbang Insurance, including the Waldorf Astoria, were basically frozen and held by the Chinese government. So this iconic American building was now in control and held by China, by Beijing.
They can't even walk into the building.
It was shut down, completely closed.
They can't put a nail in the wall.
You couldn't do anything. And so it sat on Park Avenue festering there for about another 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after that period was over, Anbang, which was restructured, took over and started rebuilding the inside. But they were behind now by about 3 years,
mm-hmm.
okay, 3.5 years. In the meantime, my career at the Palace was bolstered because I had this beautiful space and the show never ended. I walked out of the Waldorf and 1 week later was at the Palace.
Yeah.
So, it was a transition, but it was maybe even a step up for me.
Yeah.
The room I'm in at the Palace is like walking into Versailles. It's this beautiful space. I mean,
wow.
it's palatial.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something else. If you've ever seen the TV show that's called Gossip Girl, and if you've ever heard that TV show,
sure.
Gossip Girl was filmed in my hotel at the Lotte New York Palace. At the time, it was called the Helmsley Palace.
Oh, I remember the Helmsley.
Right? The Helmsley, yeah. It's a beautiful courtyard.
Mrs.
In the front.
Helmsley owned the place. Yeah,
correct. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And she left all of her money or a big portion of it to her dog named Trouble in a trust.
Correct. Yep, I remember
and
that.
And then the bar that's in the hotel now is called Trouble's Trust. That's the name of the bar.
Funny.
Which I think is hilarious. But the mansion was built in 1882, and it's intact, and it's all original. It has the original paintings, original marble, original tiles, original marble columns, and gold leaf ceilings. I mean, it's really stunning. It's like walking.
Why did you not go there first instead of to the Waldorf?
Because
the Waldorf had
I didn't even
more
know
prestige.
I didn't even know about it to
oh,
be honest.
Okay.
But the Waldorf, I was fortunate. The Waldorf did have a name value.
Okay.
Around the world, I can say to anyone, I'm the magician at the Waldorf Astoria, and instantly, boom, it was my calling card.
Well, a lot of times people think of a Waldorf salad, you know,
which was created by
of course
Oscar Turkey.
What
Oscar Turkey at the Waldorf Astoria.
Oscar, that's his real name.
That's his name, Oscar Turkey, who actually met Max Mellini. And there's an article that was in,
I
think, 1912 or 1913 or so, where Max Mellini was performing at the Waldorf in New York. And this was written up in gossip column, because everyone knew Oscar of the Waldorf. That was his nickname.
Oh.
He invented not only the Waldorf salad, but also red velvet cake.
He's the guy?
Oh, he invented Thousand that. Island dressing,
huh.
Eggs Benedict. And
he was a head chef, I guess?
No, he wasn't even a chef. He was the maitre d' of the hotel.
Oh.
Thank you, Steve, for your comments. And listeners, I guess you noticed that we ended that somewhat abruptly, but stay assured that it will continue next week and we will pick up where we left off. In fact, I'll back it up a little bit so this way you can catch up for a few sentences before we get into next week as well, in which he completes his story and talking about the Waldorf Astoria and then goes on to talking about several other things. And again, the main part of which will be talking about Max Mellini and the book that he has completed and all the information that's in that. Anyhow, that's going to be coming up next week, and that'll be part two, and it will be another episode about as long as what this one is. So please come back and listen to that. I hope that you enjoyed this first episode as much as I did. And before I close, just let me mention a couple of things. And one is to make sure that you subscribe to our pod letter so you know what's going on from week to week, who's going to be our guest and who's going to be coming up then the following week. And also occasionally we do have contests. And when we do, we will let you know and you'll be the first to know by being one of the subscribers to the free pod letter. And the pod letter is just a weekly newsletter that lets you know all this information, give you some suggestions from the archives of where you might go to listen to some other episode we had had that would be of note that you may have missed or that you should probably listen to again because I think it's one of my favorites. The other thing is, as we're getting into the holiday gift-giving season, it's about time to think about buying something through Amazon. Let me remind you that we are an affiliate, or I should say an associate affiliate, I guess, or whatever you call it, that program of Amazon. So we do get a few pennies for everything that is purchased through Amazon if you click through that link. And the link is at the bottom of every page. That is the website page of themagicwordpodcast.com. So when you go there, scroll all the way to the bottom, whether you're using an iPad or your PC or your phone, it is on the bottom there. There'll be a big ad says Amazon affiliate. And just click on that, and that will take you to your Amazon page. And anything that you purchase that is a qualified purchase, we get a little bit back from Amazon. And we thank them, and we thank you very much for doing that and for coming back week to week. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and try to create your own luck by having your preparation meet the right opportunity. This is Scotty out.